I don't know if you knew this or not, but my father moved out to California the last 4 years of his life. He lived in Shreveport, Louisiana, and really was not doing well living alone. My mother had died, and so he moved out here and had a great life out here those 4 years. The summer that he died, which was 2001, he had an angioplasty done early summer, and or maybe midsummer, and then was doing well, but then started, I think, having some little strokes and things like that, and he ended up back in the hospital. And the day after he was admitted to the hospital, he became totally senile and was imagining, hallucinating, and all intelligent conversation with my father ended at that point. Our children came over to Lodi. Our daughter lived in Brentwood over near Antioch, and our son, of course, lived in Santa Rosa. We were all gathered around his bed in the hospital, and of course, Dad is, he doesn't know what's going on. And I said to him, Dad, would you like to pray? And he sat up in bed and he said, yes. And then he began to lead us in the clearest, most lucid prayer that you can imagine. And he went around the bed and he blessed everybody that was standing there. Later, I was telling the doctor, his doctor was not making rounds that night. I think this was a Sunday night. And I told the doctor, a female, what had just happened, and her eyes welled up with tears because she realized the significance of what had just happened, that my dad snapped out of his fog and began passing on the blessing to the family. Well, Jesus did the same thing. That's really kind of the subject of what I want to talk about today. I want to look at, we're not going to look closely at John 4, 13 through 17. We're really going to zero in on chapter 15, but I want to fly over this little section of John because this constitutes Jesus' last words to his disciples before he's crucified. And I want to ask you, just for your own playfulness, perhaps, to think about what you would like to say if you were going to be passing on the blessing to your family. What would it sound like? The text that we've chosen, and you can put that up now, Rich, thank you. The text that we've chosen is John 15, 1 through 25, which one scholar calls the bullseye of this whole farewell discourse of Jesus. And so, in the outer ring, am I blocking? Can everybody see? Can you see it? The outer ring starts in chapter 13. Chapter 13 is at the Passover meal that Jesus has with his disciples, and it's the time at which he washes their feet. And so he says to them, I've done this to you because I want you to do the same for each other. And then the other side of this, the other side of this ring, is the prayer in John chapter 17, where Jesus prays to the Father and he says, I want my followers to be one in the same way that you and I are. I want them to be one in the same way that you and I are. And in chapter 13, he gave us a little picture of what that looks like. We'll spend some more time with this in a little while. The next ring, John chapter 14 and John chapter 16, he talks about the anxiety that they have. Don't let your hearts be troubled. My Father has something reserved for you. Don't be anxious, he says. Then the next ring is where he tells them about the Holy Spirit. He says in John chapter 14 and 15 that you're not going to be alone. I'm dying, I'm going away, but you're not going to be alone. The Father is going to send you an advocate, and he's going to help you and inform you and lead you, and you're not alone. Me and my Father are still involved in your life. And then the center of the bullseye, very dead center, is this passage that Noah read to us this morning about this new commandment that Jesus has given us, that we should love one another. If you look at this farewell discourse, you see that the thread that runs through the whole thing is this whole idea of our loving one another. Thanks, Rich. You can take that off now. Jesus knew that the future of the movement depended on the ability of the 12 to stick together. If they didn't stick together, if they didn't work together, if they didn't love each other, the movement would fall apart. And so Jesus pulls out of the Greek language this little obscure word that was at the very back of the dictionary. It's the word in the Greek that is pronounced agape. It's the exclusive word. There's only one other word used that's translated love, and that's phileo. And phileo is the love of friends. You know, I have friends that I love dearly, and I cannot see them for years, and then when we do see each other, we just pick up where we left off. I have a friend in Kentucky named Van, and I got an email from Van yesterday. He said, I'm panicked because I hadn't heard from you. I haven't gotten one of your tomes lately. And we have that kind of friendship. I might be at Starbucks and my phone rings and it's Van calling, just wanting to chat. That's phileo. But agape is an altogether different thing. It was the thing that the disciples needed to glue them together. At the Last Supper, everyone was sitting around, probably wondering who was going to provide the stereotypical service that you provided for your guests, and that is to wash their feet. Open-toed sandals, dusty feet, dirt roads. It was an act of hospitality. Not really weird at all in those days. It'd be weird today if you said, I want to wash your feet, and I'd say, not my feet. But back then, it was very common. It was something that everybody did. And so here are the disciples, I imagine, sitting around, maybe even wondering, well, who's going to wash my feet? Who's going to wash my feet? James and John, sons of thunder, these stormy, power-hungry guys, no way they would do it. And impetuous Peter, who was probably the leader of the group, he was the outspoken one, is probably wondering, I wonder which one of these yahoos is going to wash our feet. And there was Judas. All Judas cared about was the money bag, and he's not going to wash anybody's feet. Jesus gets up, pulls his outer robe up around his waist, ties it off with the girdle, the belt around the waist, puts on a towel, and the color drains out of everybody's face. No! You're the master. You're the teacher. You're the rabbi. You're the one we followed. You can't wash our feet. And Jesus washes all of their feet. Peter's the one that had the most problem with it. And Jesus said, unless you let me wash your feet, you don't have any part in me. And he says, well, give me a bath then. Part of Peter's sometimes stupidity. In the ethos of the kingdom, everything is upside down. And it's really the only way that it works in our world. You have to turn us upside down. The first is last. The last is first. That's not typical, is it, of our age? Go to a big event in town and watch all the posturing that goes on. Look who wants to be seen, and look who's comparing what they're wearing against what everybody else is wearing. Just watch it. It's there. And Jesus says, if you want to be first, you got to put a towel on, and you got to get busy washing feet. The act of service bonds us together in ways that nothing else does. You know, you start to sort of love somebody that you serve, don't you? You start thinking about them and praying about them and caring about their lives. And there's just something about it. Service removes animus and competition. You know, if I care about your well-being, I'm not going to be in competition with you. I care about you. The act of service distracts us from pettiness. I don't have time to think about whether or not I'm dressed the best in the room if I'm washing somebody's feet. After the Passover meal, Jesus prays for the unity of his disciples. This was that first ring. He says, "Protect those that you have given me in your name," Jesus talking to God, "so that they may be one as we are one." This unity would grow only if the disciples yielded their lives to each other. It was the only way that that would ever happen. If James and John continued to debate over who would sit at the right and left hand of Jesus, this love would never grow in that soil. It would grow as they prayed for each other, as they lived together under the rule of Christ, rather than as individuals. The Christian walk is not a solo walk. It's not. It's one of the sad things about what's happening today nationally is, you know, people being driven away from church. They're just sick of church. Sick and tired of being sick and tired. And instead, we ought to be magnetizing people. People ought to be saying, "I want some of that. I like the way they treat each other." Well, if you listened to Jesus, there was no way you could not be fearful, because he was talking about suffering and dying and rejection and all of that. And if you were hanging on his words, if you were really listening, if you were not in denial, you had to start saying, "What does that mean? What are the implications for me if this is going to happen to him?" He told Peter, he said, "Peter, you're going to deny me." Peter said, "Hell will freeze over before I deny you." That's a rough translation. He denied it. The disciples watched Jesus be arrested, beaten, subjected to a kangaroo trial. Actually, only John hung around for the crucifixion. The rest of them disappeared like rats. Though the disciples could not have fully understood at the moment what Jesus was trying to say to them, he nevertheless reassured them that God was preparing for them in an eternal sense. That you can't, it's like Peter walking on the water. You can't look at the waves. You've got to You got to look ahead. You've got to have faith that what you're doing is going to transcend what is going on around you. Chapter 16, he told them that what they were about to go through would be painful. It would be like a woman giving birth, he says. But in the end, it's glorious. We were at this Rotary fundraiser last night, and there was a woman sitting at a table right next to ours, right adjacent to ours, and she had this little baby. Oh, how old is your baby? It's my grandbaby. It's 1 month old. Aren't babies great? And her mom's over standing nearby just beaming. Was there any pain in it? Well, of course. I didn't ask that, but you know, I didn't want to get socked. But of course. And that's what Jesus was trying to get these disciples to see. It would have been so easy for them to give up, to quit, to tuck tail and run. Now, that's one of the things that impresses me about LifeSpringers. This is not a quitting group. Back during the recession, we saw some pretty low days, didn't we? And nobody said quit. Jesus said the outcome would be good. And the way he said this was, I'll come and I'll take you to myself. And my Father will give you another advocate. Those who love me, my Father loves, and he will come to them, and we'll make our home with them. When the Spirit of truth comes, he will guide you into all truth. Those are all statements just out of this farewell discourse. It's trying to assure them that it's going to be okay. When we're tempted to feel abandoned and alone, it's helpful to remember the reassurances that God gives us. Work of God is larger than any single one event. It's cosmic, it's spiritual, and it's corporate. It's corporate. It's corporate. It's all of us that God's work is directed at. And just kind of a final word on fear. I think this is interesting. This is in Ephesians 6. In Ephesians 6, Paul is telling the Ephesian Christians to put on the whole armor of God to be protected against all the junk that's going on in the world. In the backdrop, back behind the scenes, the spiritual hosts of darkness in the heavenly places that Paul talks about. And he issues several imperatives in here in this text. Now, an imperative, what that means grammatically is an imperative is do this. Scott, do this. That's an imperative. But that was imperative singular. It was addressed at Scott. And the imperatives in Ephesians 6 are all plural. So what am I saying? It's addressed to a body. It's addressed to a corporate body. It's addressed to people who stick together. And so he says, put on the armor, all of you. Take up, all of you. Stand, all of you, and so forth. No, not a singular verb among them. Well, I've mentioned my last point. I've mentioned William of Ockham before, and I'm going to do it again. He was a Franciscan friar, and he's credited with what is called Ockham's Razor. And so if you're ever reading and you see Ockham's Razor, you'll know what it's talking about. And it can be phrased or summarized in the following sentence. Explain things using the simplest possible explanation. That's Occam's razor. Pretty neat, actually. And I think that's what Jesus is doing in the center, in that bullseye. is he's explaining things in the simplest possible way. How do you remain people who are committed and unfearful? How do you, as a group of people, persevere through all of the ugliness and suffering and difficulty that's going to happen in this period of time? Love each other. Occam's razor. Love each other. That's it. All the law and the prophets are summarized in love God, love one another. Now, in a way, this is not the simplest possible explanation, because what Jesus is asking me to do is very, very difficult. It's very difficult. You know, maybe Jared is just the most obnoxious, hard to get along with person in the world. He's not, but let's pretend that he is for a moment. Jesus doesn't let me off the hook. He says, love Jared anyway. And that's where the difficulty gets in this, is because I don't get to pick and choose who I love. I don't. You could argue that that Jesus is trying to boil it down. He's trying to give the disciples something to hang their spiritual and mental hats on that would give them a direction for the future. And I think that, you know, if you look at the role that love plays in our lives, this is the most logical response to being Jesus' disciple. It's where it all leads me, is that I'm trying to become a more loving person in my relationships. And it also helps to define the intimacy that Jesus has with us. You know, Jesus in this text says, I've called you friends. You're no longer servants, you're my friends. I was out Saturday morning on my... Bella and I took a 4-mile walk, and so we'd kind of passed the halfway point. We were getting close to heading back to the house. We were out east of McKee, and there's this neighborhood that we walk around the perimeter of, and while I was over in that neighborhood, I bumped into a friend. First, I didn't recognize him. He just came down the street on a bike, and he was all suited up. He had his helmet on, and I just waved, and somebody said, Bruce, turned around, and he turned his bike around, and it issued in a 15 or 20 minute conversation. That's what friendship is. I said, you know, I really didn't want to do this walk this morning, but you have blessed my day, and I'm thankful that I bumped into you. That's friendship. And Jesus says, I've called you my friends. You're closer than family. You're closer than family. Friends are somebody that you choose, right? You're closer than family. I'd like to also add, and then I'll conclude, that love is the best method that we have in the world. It's the best thing that we can do. The world is a desperately dark place, and people don't know what this looks like, what Jesus is modeling for his disciples and what he's called us to model. The world is always surprised when it shows up. I can tell you. You grace somebody, and they know they've been graced. And it's the most powerful thing that you have to use as you try to talk to other people about your faith. It's just the way that you treat them. Well, between John 13 and John 17, we're moved toward the bullseye. There's this thread that pulls us through it, and that thread is love. It is the supreme virtue. There is no greater thing that I could aspire to in my life. Indeed, if I aspire to love and go after love, everything else falls into place. If I'm a loving person, you know, if I love Gregory, then I start dealing with the anger in my life, or my need to be a more compassionate person, or whatever. Greed, you know. I don't start coveting what Gregory has because I love him. It changes everything in my life when I do that. You can also see how with love in our lives, we have stronger churches, greater impact on the world around us. It all falls into place when this one thing is in place. And it is a community that can face difficulty and win. It just gives us a unique perspective on this life. So I want to leave you with this farewell discourse. And maybe you could just think about what your farewell discourse would be. What would you like to tell people in the ultimate sense about life, about being a disciple of Jesus? What would you say? What would your discourse look like? Let's pray. Dear God, we want lives that have love at their center. Lives that are defined by their selfless service and courageous walk. Give us lives like that, lives filled with your Spirit. In Jesus' name I pray this.